I had to wait to the end to see if that resolved. And it's ambiguous, isn't it? Don't know the genre much. They all sound like Alison Krauss to me. But my name's Paul Muth, and I'm checking on that, too. It's WEFT, Champaign, Urbana, and Environs, I like to say. East Central Illinois. And this is News for Neptune, the radio edit. Sometimes I call it that. Dedicated to Noam Chomsky, who had a birthday this month anyway. Okay, all right. Wisconsin, it's in native son Jeremy Scahill's discerning eye today. Got about a half hour interview with a new author writing about Wisconsin. Let's see whether they can find a judge that will say this is profoundly undemocratic what you're doing here, but I don't know if that goes to state or federal. Some state constitutions, and I assume the populist constitution has the right to vote in it, I think, and right to a fair vote, maybe. In Pennsylvania, they used the state constitution to get rid of gerrymandering there, and it had an effect on the constituency of the delegation to Washington in a big way. I don't know how many they gained there. I wonder if that's possible in Wisconsin, since gerrymandering is a big issue there. It's one of the things that's passed upon. Amy Goodman has been off in Poland. She's taken a slow boat back from the area, or probably not, since she has to get back in a New York minute. Dirigible would be fast enough. I don't know why anybody's not talking about the footprint of a lighter-than-air vehicle. Take a little longer, but probably not hold that much, and it would be much less consumptive of any kind of product. I know they're talking about trying to find plant renewable jet fuels, but helium-lofted dirigibles are a really logical thing, and I can't believe nobody's proposing it yet. But me. Maybe you've heard it somewhere else. Let's see. Am I doing a talk under? No, I'm not. That's a good thing. Let's get rid of Zara so I don't do that later. Amy Goodman, being busy, did not voice her essay, so I think I'm going to read it. I got one from Mumi Abu-Jamal, don't I? And why don't we hear that right now? He is commemorating an intellectual hero of his, I guess, Howard Kilo, just hit the centenary mark, apparently. Good occasion. Behind the News is on hiatus, so I picked a show from the 17th of November. They're on hiatus. Well, they're not on hiatus, but they're doing pledge drive editions, and they might be preempted, but KPFA is having their midwinter pledge drive where they're looking for a huge amount of money, and they've been having shortfalls too. Oh, well, since COP24 has been in the news, and this whole business about what are they actually, what language is bracketed still, what are they discussing, Amy Goodman has an interview with an Indian fellow that is from New Delhi, India. That kind of lays it out. So I'm going to hear web exclusive. You can find it on her page, on the Democracy Now! Page, pretty easily. It's the only web exclusive she generated while there. Her essay, which I'm going to read, I guess, is about youth input into the climate change, climate chaos conference, I like to call it. And if you didn't hear the Swedish young woman, 12-year-old maybe, she's mildly Asperger, spectrum, whatever they call it these days. And she focuses on the future of the world's climate, and it is amazing. She is brilliant, absolutely astonishing. I'm sure she'll be mentioned in this essay when I read it. I haven't done a pre-read, so bear with me. But let's hear Mumi Abu-Jamal. 37 years in jail, now not on death row, and they're treating his conditions. There is some chance of having a judicial review of his case, in which case the judge was a known racist, was overheard talking about getting that N-word, among a bunch of other irregularities. Jailhouse snitch, woman trading testimony for a lesser sentence, something they had her on, and the usual panoply of judicial malfeasance. Let's see. I think I already told you about the opinions not reflecting others at the station necessarily. I haven't mentioned the tower rusting out. We had a very generous donation, so I'm feeling very much more confident. I've been pretty despondent about getting it together. But things are still going to be tough, so if you have any windfalls of your own or anything like that, payroll deduction is really the way to go, and you can still arrange that even though it's not technically the combined charitable campaign or whatever they're calling it now. Okay, I didn't do this yet, did I? So, here's Mumi Abu-Jamal with his short commentary, and then I'll do a quick prep on reading Amy Goodman's Breaking the Sound Barrier essay.
Third birthday to Howard Kaler. Dear brother, sisters, comrades, and friends of ILWU Local 10, on the move, I join you all in celebrating the remarkable life and struggle of ILWU's longest living member, Howard Kaler, a trade unionist and revolutionary who used labor power to defend every major social movement for freedom, justice, and workers' rights the world over. From opposing the vicious apartheid system in South Africa to opposing the American Nazi group, from strikes against police brutality to struggling for my life and freedom in 1999. Howard's life work is a reflection of ILWU's battles and struggles, yes, but it's also a reflection of the human rights movement for much of the 20th century, and yet, even the 21st. Brother Howard, I salute you. You bring great honor to the ILWU, and you serve as a powerful example of labor power. Happy 93rd birthday, brother. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumi Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Oh, okay, only my mother's age. 93, not 100. I thought I heard that. Okay. Let's see if I'm Inter Wisconsin. That's it. For all the times I've heard her do the introduction, I still don't quite know the pronunciation of the town in Poland. A conference center that's designed on to be like a coal mine or something. I can't envision that. I'd like to, maybe I should look for some stills, or maybe somebody did a walking tour of it or something. But anyway, here's at the UN Climate Summit, Youth Leads the Way. It says 5 to 6 minutes. Okay. Close to 15,000 people have descended on Katowice in the heart of Poland's coal country for the annual UN Climate Change Summit. This meeting is dubbed COP24 for the 24th Conference of the Parties. Sounds deceptive, parenthetically, to the climate negotiation. The efforts to curb greenhouse gas emissions and limit global warming has been ongoing since Rio Earth Summit in 92. Did you hear much about George Herbert Walker Bush's role in that? It was deceptive. He came back and then betrayed all of the good words he had said about it. So I guess that's not unusual. Back to the text. Among those gathered are two young women from the global north and south who have decided to devote their lives to reversing humanity's destructive addiction to fossil fuels, hopefully before it's too late. Quoting Antonio Guterres, addressing UN Secretary Antonio Guterres, Greta Thunberg, Thunberg, 15 years old. Since our leaders are behaving like children, we will have to take the responsibility they should have taken long ago. Greta began studying the issue of climate change at the age of 9. She said on Democracy Now! NewsHour at COP24 that over time she fell into a depression. I didn't see any point of living because everything was just so wrong. She stopped eating, stopped talking. Her father, an actor, and her mother, a world-famous opera singer, stopped work to stay with her, caring for her through this difficult period, through her recovery. She, as I mentioned, is on the Asperger spectrum, is diagnosis in Sweden, I guess, too. Quoting her again, I thought that I could do so much with my life. What is the point of feeling like this? And what could actually do something good? Greta has Asperger's. Because of this, she said, I work a bit different. I see things black and white. I guess I saw the world from a different perspective. So much for foreshadowing. Starting last August, Greta began, quote, a school strike, standing in front of the Swedish parliament instead of going to school. After the Swedish election September, she resumed school, maintaining her strikes on Friday. Perhaps she mentions here in the next text that there were some school strikes going around on around the world after her activity was came to light. Back to the text, renowned climate scientist Kevin Anderson tweeted, on climate change, Greta Thunberg demonstrates more clarity and leadership in one speech than a quarter of a century of combined contributions of so-called world leaders. Willful ignorance and lies have overseen a 65% rise in CO2 since 1990. Time to hand over the baton. Nearing midnight on Wednesday at COP24, Greta addressed a plenary session, midnight Polish time. Our civilization is being sacrificed for the opportunity for a very small number of people to continue making enormous amounts of money. Our biosphere is being sacrificed so that rich people in countries like mine can live in luxury. It is the suffering of the many which pays for the luxuries of the few. Joanne Sustento, a 26-year-old climate survivor from the Philippines who knows that suffering too well. I had a happy life, a good job, great friends, and a wonderful, loving family. But in a matter of minutes, all that changed. Joanna said on a Greenpeace Philippines video describing the November 8, 2013, when Typhoon Haiyan hit her home of Tacloban. Typhoon Haiyan killed more than 10,000 people and left over 14 million homeless. She said on Democracy Now! In Katowice, quoting, I witnessed my mother, my father, brother, sister-in-law, and my three-year-old nephew being swept away by the storm surge. It left my brother and me to search for our family's bodies in the aftermath. We never found our father and our nephew. It is difficult to be the one left behind. We've had to deal with all the questions, the grief, the pain, and the regrets. Johanna then described the first-of-its-kind effort to hold polluting corporations called the Carbon Majors accountable. Shell, BP, Chevron, ExxonMobil, Suncor, Lukoil, those are just some of the 47 companies named present in the Philippines. Petition has been filed. 47 companies in one country. A petition was filed in 2015 by typhoon survivors, fisherfolk, farmers, and other environmental organizations at the Commission of Human Rights of the Philippines to investigate oil, coal, and gas companies for their responsibility for human rights violations resulting from climate change. Like Greta Thunberg, Johanna Sustento is in the struggle for climate justice for the long haul. I see that there is so much power in the people out there, so much power to pressure our governments, corporations, to change the current system, she said. Greta closed her plenary remarks Wednesday night, concluding, "You have run out of excuses and we're running out of time. We have come here to let you know that change is coming whether you like it or not. The real power belongs to the people." At COP24, held at Conference Center atop an old coal mine in the part of the world that has witnessed the worst ravages of war, the gathered heads of states and their climate negotiators should listen to the words of these two wise young women. Well-crafted speech. I wish she had time to have voiced it, but I think she's getting deserved rest now. That's Breaking the Sound Barrier essay, which is usually in her voice with little quotes. You would have heard the brilliant Ms. Thunberg in her own voice had it been they had time to put it together. So, I better get to it, considering that I've got a 30-minute piece from Jeremy Scahill and then a 17-minute piece from Democracy Now! From the COP2, one of her web their only web exclusive while she was there. I can't not mention the young woman that died, that Jacqueline Kahn, forget how to say her name exactly, in custody of the Border Patrol, same Border Patrol that has gone around the desert and picked up water and dumped it on the ground. And they're charging people that are doing this service to migrants in the desert with a variety of charges of littering, one of which is a felony. So felony littering. So we've heard people talk about how these are kind people. They're just in a bad circumstance. But it's a system that is revoltingly disgusting, and I better stop now or I'm going to break up. Here is a little skit at the beginning, which features POTUS in his own voice. Yuck.
I never take anything for granted. Only a fool maybe takes things for granted. Just because it's here today, it can be gone tomorrow. Baby, I love you. Just the way you are.
I'm a very stable genius.
My touch, my feel, that's what I do.
Did anyone ever hear me do the snake? Even look at Roseanne, I called her yesterday.
Yes, please, Mr. Kurd.
And then we fell in love.
Okay.
The sentence should have been, I don't see any reason why it wouldn't be Russia.
I know all about flipping. For 30, 40 years, I've been watching flippers.
One of the wettest we've ever seen from the standpoint of water.
It's really an ominous, gutless coward.
Weeds. And they're raking them. They're on fire.
Please, don't be a baby, okay?
A lot of the rich guys like rockets.
People call it Britain. They call it Great Britain. They used to call it England, different parts.
Just remember, what you're seeing and what you're reading is not what's happening.
Don't go changing, trying to please me. You never let me down before. I want you just the way you are.
This is Intercepted. I'm Jeremy Scahill, coming to you from the offices of The Intercept in New York City, and this is episode 77 of Intercepted.
Show them what democracy looks like!
On December 3rd, people began to gather at the Wisconsin State Capitol to protest the lame duck Republican legislature's late night conspiracy to strip away the power of newly elected Democratic officials, including the incoming governor who unseated the right-wing darling, Scott Walker.
I do not believe that a single stroke of the pen by a governor of either party should be able to undo the work of the legislature in negotiation with the executive branch. Those are the kind of things that are in this bill today, making sure that the practices that we have had where both sides sit at the table and neither one is able to unilaterally do something.
I'm concerned. I think that Governor-elect Evers is going to bring a liberal agenda to Wisconsin.
That's Republican Speaker of the Wisconsin State Assembly, Robin Voss, and State Senate Majority Leader, Scott Fitzgerald, justifying their power grab. The proposal, passed by the State Assembly and Senate on December 5th, will weaken the governor's ability to make rules that enact laws, and it gives lawmakers the ability to control appointees to the Economic Development Agency. The sweeping changes also aim to prevent the incoming Democratic Attorney General, Josh Call, from withdrawing the state from a lawsuit against the Affordable Care Act. Early voting would also be cut down to just 2 weeks prior to elections. That's a move clearly intended to suppress black votes in Milwaukee. On Meet the Press on Sunday, Chuck Todd interviewed Democratic Governor-elect Tony Evers, and Todd offered a less-than-factual analysis, saying that this Republican preemptive coup was essentially business as usual, and that Democrats have engaged in similar campaigns.
Now, this has happened before in many a legislature. Democrats, in fact, have done this in the past to Republican governors in lame duck sessions in other states.
Chuck Todd offered no evidence to back up this claim, and by all accounts, such actions have been rare, particularly when you consider the scope of these actions in Wisconsin. On that same show, Governor-elect Evers talked about his efforts to convince the outgoing Governor Scott Walker to veto the bill.
Vetoing the legislation was going to be an important thing, not only for, you know, to make sure that our what happened last November, the vote of the people of Wisconsin, is actually upheld and we're putting people in front of politics, but also it's just bad legislation. And I made that pitch, and he was noncommittal.
Now, as we went to air, Scott Walker had not yet signed this bill, but he did go on social media on Tuesday to defend the measures, saying, quote, the new governor will still have some of the strongest powers of any governor in the nation if these bills become law. Wisconsin emerged as one of the main battlegrounds in the 2016 election, and Hillary Clinton famously never set foot in the state during the campaign.
So I just don't believe that those were the determining factors about how many visits, how many people made. I just don't buy that.
But there's a deeper context to why she failed to win Wisconsin and why Trump won, and also a deeper context to how an extreme right winger like Scott Walker ever even rose to power in a state famous for its progressive politics. My guest today has been studying Wisconsin for, well, his whole life, really. He wrote the following, quote, Donald Trump's victory may have shocked the Clinton campaign and media pundits, but the result merely heralded the final stage of Wisconsin's dramatic transformation from a pioneering beacon of progressive Democratic politics to the embodiment of that legacy's national unraveling. Powerful conservative donors and organizations across the country had Wisconsin in their sights years before the 2016 presidential election, helping Governor Scott Walker and his allies systematically change the state's political culture. So how did Wisconsin go from a laboratory of democracy and progressive politics to become a testing ground for right-wing policies? Joining me now to break down the latest on what's happening in Wisconsin and try to tackle that question and how we got here is Dan Kaufman. Like me, he's from Wisconsin. He grew up in Madison. I grew up in Milwaukee. Kaufman is the author of a deeply reported and fascinating new book. It's called The Fall of Wisconsin: Conservative Conquest of a Progressive Bastion and the Future of American Politics. The New Yorker's Jane Mayer praised the book, saying, quote, through the microcosm of one state, Dan Kaufman does a masterful job explaining what's happened to America and why. It's not a happy tale, but it's an important one. Dan Kaufman joins me now. Dan, welcome to Intercepted.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeremy. It's great to be here.
So let's start just with a 101 overview of what happened in Wisconsin after Tony Evers beat Scott Walker.
Well, within 24 hours, less than 24 hours, the Speaker of the Assembly, Robin Voss, floated the idea that they were going to make some changes during the lame duck session, basically stripping Governor-elect Evers of some of his powers. They were very unspecific about what they were. But some of the ideas floated immediately were to limit his control over a very powerful economic development corporation called the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, which has was the liaison for the Foxconn deal. Foxconn, the world's largest contract electronics manufacturer, and it is being wooed to Wisconsin at the cost to taxpayers now of more than $4.5 billion to a place just outside Racine called Mount Pleasant. Walker spearheaded this deal. It was also enabled by President Trump. Foxconn's first American plant, it was supposed to bring back good-paying manufacturing jobs to Wisconsin, but it's turned into a boondoggle. That was one thing. Another thing that they talked about was restricting Governor Evers' ability to withdraw Wisconsin from a multi-state lawsuit against the Affordable Care Act. He campaigned on this, Governor Evers did, and he won, as well as campaigned on criticism of the Foxconn deal.
To beat Scott Walker, we need a stronger vision for our future. Instead of investing $1 billion in handouts to companies like Foxconn, I'm going to invest in our kids and our workers.
So they were challenging the things that he had actually campaigned on. To understand how absurd this is, you have to look at how extensively gerrymandered Wisconsin is. The Republicans have a stranglehold on the state legislature, in large part, not exclusively, because of gerrymandering. in the November elections. Democrats won all statewide offices, and yet they only gained a single assembly seat and lost a state Senate seat. They now have 36 assembly seats out of 99. It's never been more than 39 out of 99 in four elections since a very extreme secretive gerrymandering was pushed through in 2011.
Well, and you had Scott Fitzgerald, who is the majority leader in the Wisconsin State Senate, and he said the following, quote, if you took Madison and Milwaukee out of the state election formula, we would have a clear majority. We would have all five constitutional officers, and we would probably have many more seats in the legislature.
Well, Milwaukee, a lot of people read that as a coded language for African-Americans. And Dane County, where Madison is really the economic engine of the entire state. It's the only place that's really growing in population, and the university system is the state's largest employer. It was quite an extraordinary statement, as though those votes didn't matter. And they've said also the legislature is the most representative branch of government. Whether or not that's true in the abstract, it certainly isn't true in Wisconsin. In fact, it's the least representative because of this gerrymandering. They're basically impervious to elections. They cannot be unseated. Their majority can't really be unseated. It's so heavily gerrymandered that a federal court ruled for the first time in 30 years that it was denying Democrats their constitutional rights. And then it went to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court sent it back saying the plaintiffs don't have standing. But it was so extreme that that was the result.
And is this happening in other states? Is this an unprecedented kind of preemptive coup of sorts against this Democratic incoming governor?
No, it actually happened first in North Carolina, very similarly in 2016, when a Democratic governor won and broke up one-party rule there. They immediately began very aggressive stripping of his powers. In fact, it was so extreme that earlier this year, at the beginning of the legislative session, a reporter asked the leader of the Senate, do you plan on stripping any more of Governor Cooper's power? That's the Democratic governor. And the Senate Majority Leader joked and said,
does he still have any?
You have any suggestions, let us know.
It's very extreme there. And now they're talking about doing the same thing in Michigan. And this is telling because Wisconsin has been a kind of laboratory for a lot of this conservative ideology. This is one example where Wisconsin didn't lead it, but it's adopted some of the most extreme policies that are generated often by groups not from the state, most notoriously the American Legislative Exchange Council, a secretive group that was founded in the early 70s, largely, in a sense, by Paul Weyrich, a very important new right activist who built a lot of this national conservative infrastructure. And in the Tea Party wave of 2010, when Governor Walker was elected and the Republicans seized both houses of the state legislature, they began passing these very extreme policies that were, a lot of them were sort of copycat bills from ALEC. Labor rights were curtailed, voting rights, a lot of things were changed.
And just to remind people that ALEC, which you're talking about, major recipient of funding from the Koch brothers as well.
I actually went to two ALEC meetings, interestingly enough, and it's very rare that they let a reporter in. And I saw how it works. What it does is it brings together corporate lobbyists, fellows, and analysts from conservative think tanks and state legislators. There's a very progressive Democratic assemblywoman named Chris Taylor, who has joined ALEC as a kind of out spy. It's officially a nonpartisan group. It has that's its IRS tax status. So she goes simply to report back on what is coming next for Wisconsin. And she joked with me in my book, I follow her around to these ALEC meetings. She says the state legislators are real. It's like a three-legged stool is how she describes it. These corporate lobbyists like ExxonMobil, pharma, the pharmaceutical trade lobbying group. And then you have these right-wing think tanks like the Goldwater Institute and so on, especially in education policy, privatizing education. And then you have the state legislators. And in her view, the state legislators are the junior partner and they're sort of handed the stuff and say, go out and do this. And they don't necessarily even have a great idea of what it is. There's other ways it works too, though. For example, the Trayvon Martin Stand Your Ground bill was drafted by an NRA lobbyist in Florida, brought to an ALEC meeting as a model, then was adopted by this task force, and then disseminated. So sometimes it's tried out in a state first, brought to them, but it acts as a disseminator and propagator to a wider audience. And then 26 states, including Wisconsin, adopted a version of that Stand Your Ground law. Immediately, bad policy was being replicated on essentially a national scale, wherever they had control.
What's the ultimate agenda, or what are the priorities of the kind of coup leaders in the Wisconsin legislature now who are preemptively stripping Evers of this power? Like, what are their main priorities? Why did they do this? What do they want to achieve?
Well, I think it's really about holding on to power at all costs. It's a tragedy for the citizens of the state. In some ways, it's more of an outrage than even than Act 10, which was the name for the law that stripped most public employees of their collective bargaining rights in 2011.
Well, the national media is saying that Wisconsin
chamber has lost, that the bills have been passed in the House and the Senate and signed off on by Governor Walker that would end collective bargaining rights for most of the public employees in this state. It doesn't feel like a loss today. Well over 100,000 people are here at the Capitol.
But the voters, it's stripping them of their vote. It's a rise of minority rule. It is emblematic of our times. The Republican Party now is a very relentless and very cohesive machine. Nowhere has that been proven more true than in Wisconsin. They are willing to undo 100 years of good, pragmatic, progressive legislation. A lot of this legislation is about engineering their own dominance. For example, decimating the labor movement, bankrupted the labor movement, which was a prime donor to the Democratic Party. I mean, their founder, Paul Weyrich, had said outright that it's not good if everyone votes. Frankly, our leverage goes down. This undemocratic strain, I think, is a strain in the libertarian right.
It's important to point out that in these midterm elections in 2018, that Democrats won all five statewide elections. And you have Republican leaders in Wisconsin essentially, or in some cases just blatantly admitting that they passed this plan specifically to undermine the will of the statewide vote.
Right. So concerned about winning power, they were going to add a third election in 2020 to make a Supreme Court judicial election, not on the same day as the Democratic presidential primary, which they expected high turnout. So that would have made three elections in three consecutive months. It was an extra cost of $7 million. You have to remember, this is a party that always talks about the taxpayer, but they're just, you know, they're adding something for no reason. And the Senate Majority Leader, Scott Fitzgerald, said, he was very honest. He told reporters it was to give their candidate, who was a Walker appointee, who was going to be running for his first full term, a better chance at winning. That was stripped out because it was just too far. But it tells you something about what is driving it. But it's not just this issue. I think this issue is the denouement of 8 years of this, you know, this desire, this quest for power. And when you look at these other policies like the right to work law, the so-called right to work law, Act 10, the gutting of campaign finance laws, they all ultimately can be read as a way to engineer their political dominance, the gerrymandering. They're all pieces of it. It doesn't ensure it absolutely, but when you add it together cumulatively, it makes for a very powerful machine.
You've written an incredible book that doesn't just tell a story of Wisconsin, that contains lessons for other states that are facing not necessarily the same history as Wisconsin, but right-wing attempts to manipulate or undermine the will of Democratic voters. And it's not lost on people that Hillary Clinton won that election in terms of votes, but lost it because of a sort of equally arcane and vicious process that is the Electoral College. But the title of your book is The Fall of Wisconsin, Conservative Conquest of a Progressive Bastion and the Future of American Politics. Give people a sense or some vignettes of the progressive history of Wisconsin and why it has that historical reputation as being the state of fighting Bob La Follette and sort of progressivism.
Robert La Follette, who was kind of the pivotal figure of Wisconsin progressivism. He was a governor and senator, but also a failed third-party candidate for president in 1924 on the Progressive Party ticket. And La Follette, his two, I think, most important ideas were the need to restrain corporate influence on government. And the other was that democracy is only workable if there's active citizenship, if people are actively engaged. So he created a lot of reforms as governor to open up the process, banning corporate donations to candidates, but also instituting direct primaries. And he also forged an unusually strong relationship with the state university. He felt like he was a graduate of that university, and he wanted to draw on the expertise of faculty to create pragmatic, progressive legislation that would help the citizens as a whole. So out of this, you had the first workers' compensation law, you had child labor laws, you had a lot of progressive reforms. In fact, some people say that the New Deal was basically the Wisconsin idea writ large.
Well, in fact, you tell this story of Franklin Roosevelt being in the White House, and then you say that Wisconsinites start to move to Washington,
exactly.
And you see the impact of La Follette's ideas and this experiment that he's engaged in Wisconsin being adopted at a federal level. It was also the it was almost the moral equivalent of what Tommy Thompson would do many decades later when he was governor of Wisconsin, where his crime bill and his welfare, quote unquote, reform stuff got picked up by Clinton on a national level. But talk about that era of the New Deal, Roosevelt, and the nationalization of the ideas of Robert La Follette.
Absolutely. And that's a good point. At one stage, it was a progressive laboratory for the country, and then it became a conservative one. But yes, the whole idea of social insurance, in a way, came out of the Wisconsin idea. The Social Security Act was drafted by Wisconsinites loyal to this idea. Edwin Witte, Wilbur Cohen. Wilbur Cohen went on to draft the Medicare program 30 years later. Unemployment insurance, which had first been instituted in Wisconsin, was then nationalized. That there's some kind of social insurance to protect the elderly, to protect workers, and so on. All of this came from the University of Wisconsin. A lot of it, one of the influences was one of the early chancellors, John Bascom, huge influence on Robert La Follette. And another one, and I want to just read this epigraph of the book because I think it captures the spirit, was the Chief Justice of the Wisconsin Supreme Court in the 1870s, a man named Edward G. Ryan. La Follette actually heard this speech before he had enrolled in Wisconsin. He was going to be a freshman, and he happened to be there. And one of the key points Ryan made was railing against this corporate influence in the state's government. And he said, "The question will arise and arise in your day, though perhaps not fully in mine. Which shall rule, wealth or man? Which shall lead, money or intellect? Who shall fill public stations, educated and patriotic free men or the feudal serfs of corporate capital?" And it's an amazing quote. When I found it, it was just spoke to our age so clearly. And these reforms, and I hope people take from the book that there's also a different kind of model could exist, that this progressive history has been lost, a lot of it. And it was really common sense, pragmatic things that endured, particularly the state's commitment to open, transparent government, which was really overturned
but also,
the last 8 years.
You know, Wisconsin, and just full disclosure, but Dan and I both are from Wisconsin. He's from Madison. I'm from Milwaukee. But speaking of Milwaukee, that city had a string of socialist mayors, last being the great Frank Zeidler, who also was a candidate for president. I believe he ran as a socialist, as the Socialist Party candidate.
In the 1970s
for president. But you really have, it's not just a progressive tradition in Wisconsin. You also had very cutting edge thinkers who were looking globally at what happened in the Soviet Union with the Russian Revolution, with the rise of huge industrial capitalism. And on a local level and a state level, you had these two lions, basically, in Bob La Follette and Frank Zeidler and the socialist mayors in Milwaukee.
Absolutely. And I talk about that tradition. It's a really important reformist socialist tradition that was derided by people as sewer socialism, but it left such a lasting public legacy for the city of Milwaukee and for the state. And while they had sometimes a fractious coalition, the La Follette progressives and the socialists, they did work together, and the socialists endorsed La Follette for his bid. And I think at the core of it is this idea of the public sector, the belief in the public sector, which has been so stripped both by Republicans and Democrats.
Describe the significance of what Tommy Thompson did when he was governor of the state of Wisconsin. And what I'm getting at, I mentioned it or alluded to it earlier, but Thompson really created a model on the state level on a number of fronts, labor, welfare, crime, that were adopted by the Democratic administration of Bill Clinton. Explain the significance of Tommy Thompson's time in power and when it stretched from when to when.
Right. He was elected, I think, in the late 80s, and he served four terms. He was tremendously popular. He had a very different style than Scott Walker. But as you say, he was a kind of bridge figure between that earlier era and now a more extreme version. He did certain things that were more in the spirit of the old Wisconsin. For example, he was relatively good on conservation issues. But in terms of education and welfare, he did test Wisconsin as a kind of model for creating private school vouchers, giving money from the public school budget. This was the first time this had happened to private schools, mainly religious schools in Milwaukee. So that was draining the public school budget. The other thing he did was welfare, so-called reform, where people were made to work for their welfare benefits, and welfare benefits were limited. These policies were then adopted by Bill Clinton. But Tommy Thompson was an ALEC member as well, and he famously said, I think it was in 2002, that, you know, I love going to ALEC, meetings because I can take these ideas, disguise them a little bit, and then say that they're mine. That's a paraphrase. And this is how conservative policy gets out there. And really, the big drivers of it that I saw when I was at the two ALEC meetings I went was not even the corporations, but these conservative think tanks like the Goldwater Institute or Betsy DeVos's, I think it's called American Federation for Children, all kinds of these think tanks dreaming up libertarian ideas, literature and so on, in a place for people to meet from all over the country to kind of disseminate these ideas, attacking labor, attacking environmental regulations, attacking the idea of a public sphere. Their ideal is a kind of libertarian society that is, to some of us, fairly terrifying.
Let's talk about 2016. Correct me if I'm wrong, Hillary Clinton did not set foot in the state of Wisconsin while campaigning for president in 2016.
Not during the general election, no. No, once she was the nominee, she did not appear there once.
What happened in Wisconsin? Why did Trump win?
You know, Trump actually did worse than Mitt Romney in 2012. He got 6,000 fewer votes. I think what you had was the absence of Clinton. She had no real message for the working class voters. There was a lot of Democratic disaffection, both in the African-American community and in the working class community. Some white working class people switched over to Trump. That's definitely true. He also, people forget, he made five big campaign stops in Wisconsin during the general election. At each one of them, he railed against NAFTA and the TPP and China's admittance to the WTO. Maybe not each one of them, but often. He also said he was going to defend Social Security and Medicare. So a lot of his core messaging had a Democratic undercurrent to it. There was also a lot of racial resentment. It was twinned message. He won Kenosha County, which is a very deindustrialized place right on the Illinois border, whereas Obama had won it by 13 points. He narrowly won it. It used to be the home of the American Motors Corporation, now gone. And he promised good jobs, and people were desperate for that. Southeastern Wisconsin is a manufacturing powerhouse, or was. You know, Milwaukee was called, I think it was Toolmaker of the World or something like that. It was an incredible nexus of those kinds of get out of high school, work in a factory, have a good life for your family, union jobs. Those are gone, a lot of them.
Well, you would see, I mean, just even culturally, the sitcoms that were situated
Laverne
in Wisconsin,
and Shirley,
Laverne and Shirley.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, Schlemiel, Schlemazel, Hassan Beff Incorporated. We're
gonna do it. Happy Days.
Right.
You got that feel. These were working class.
It's a blue-collar town with a lot of class consciousness. And plus, you know, gerrymandering, it withers political activity in various places. So I think, you know, in some of these rural communities, when there was no chance for their Democratic state senator or state assembly person to win, disaffection grows. And you had that. You had a very strict voter ID law. That probably did affect some of the turnout, especially in Black Milwaukee.
Oh, some Black districts in Milwaukee had almost 20% decline in voting from 2012 to 2016.
Right. It's almost like her defeat was overdetermined. You could take any one of those things and they combined. She only lost by 23,000 votes. In Michigan, it was even less. But again, she was not a friend of labor for many decades. She had been on the board of Walmart. It's a notoriously anti-union company. And then she also really supported NAFTA and the TPP. And I think people on the coast don't get the salience of free trade in the industrial Midwest. You can talk about automation or other things, but they can point you, this factory moved to Mexico, this factory moved to China. And you have to remember, Bernie Sanders did very well in Wisconsin. He won by 13 points. And a lot of people saw in his message some echo, especially on the progressive side, of that La Follette tradition.
You've done this deep dive historical arc on Wisconsin. What's next there? And what should people be looking for now that you have an incoming Democratic administration that has essentially been kneecapped by the Republican state lawmakers?
Yes, I think it will be a kind of trench warfare for the next 2 years. There'll be a lot of court battles. The thing that you see is people's morale wavering a bit sometimes. They've been the subject to 8 years of attacks on long established, you know, traditions. That said, I think it reawakened a lot of outrage in people because they had won the election. It's much more complicated than a blue wave or anything like that. These are deep-seated structural changes that the Republicans have attempted. And the force that's opposing them really the most is civil society. Whether they can continue their opposition will remain to be seen.
Dan Kaufman, thank you very much for your work, and thanks for joining us on Intercepted.
Thanks, Jeremy. It was really a pleasure.
Dan Kaufman is the author of The Fall of Wisconsin, Conservative Conquest of a Progressive Bastion and the Future of American Politics. You can find Dan at Dan Kaufman70. Dan is also a musician, and his band has a new album out in honor of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade.
Which you can find at the Intercepted podcast, along with the interview about this false accusation Murderville podcast that's apparently done by two people that work for The Intercept and a Canadian hip-hop artist called Shad. Don't know about him either, but it was an interesting story. I recommend it, and recommend also this to your attention, which is the next segment. We'll see whether, I think I'm going to slew forward a little bit and get you can commend your attention to the entirety of it on the Democracy Now! Web exclusive segment. This is a further interview with a climate activist. And let's see if we have that handy, because I'm going to go forward. He's from Delhi, has a name that is a little hard for me to say as well. Perhaps we'll hear the outro. Perhaps not. This is titled Climate Migrants, Millions More Could Be Displaced by Global Warming as Carbon Emissions Rise. Drought in Syria, drought in Central America don't get mentioned. This is a guy with a group called Action Aid. I guess I'll click on them while I'm listening. Harjeet Singh. It's not that hard. And since I only have 16 minutes left, let's try to get it all on. There's a last segment where she asks him specifically about Indian conditions in subcontinental India. I mean, we may have to skip that, but you can find that as well. It's dry there. Monsoons are not so regular.
That's built to look like a coal mine. In fact, it's on the property of an old coal mine. We're about an hour from Krakow and about the same distance from Auschwitz, the World War II Nazi concentration camp where close to 1 million Jews died. I'm Amy Goodman. We continue our look today at how the United States and the world's other worst emitters are hindering negotiations here at the UN Climate Summit in Poland, even as countries from the global south warn they can face annihilation without drastic action to confront climate change. Still with us for part two of our discussion is Harjeet Singh, the global lead on climate change for Action Aid. He's been working with climate migrants in a number of countries, based himself in New Delhi, India. It's great to continue to speak to you, Harjeet. We ended part one talking about the scope of the problem. And if you could lay out the effects of climate change, and then I want to focus on climate migrants.
So in developing countries, we are seeing how livelihoods are being impacted. People are losing their homes, and they have no option left but to leave their homes and families behind. When we talk about displacement or climate migration, it clearly means that the local coping mechanisms have failed. Climate displacement is the epitome of climate impacts. Nobody would like to leave their homes and families behind. And we are seeing impacts rising, be it sea level rise, increasing number of hurricanes, their intensity is increasing, we are facing unprecedented droughts, and people do not have really the capacity to cope. By the time they try to recover from the previous shock, another one hits them and hits them harder. And poor countries do not have resources to provide them relief, to help them reconstruct their homes and rebuild their lives. And when it comes to UNFCCC negotiations, the discussion on finance is so difficult. It's not moving forward. And at this moment, when the rule book is being developed, the discussion is around predictability of finance and accounting. In 2016, developed countries came up with a report saying we are on track to provide $100 billion, but the report was full of cooked up numbers and dodgy methodology to count the money. And
how do you answer people in the United States, certainly the Trump administration, who might say, why help other countries? We have to, well, he's talking about America first.
Let us understand who has caused this problem. It's 150 plus years of industrialization, and the US and other bigger countries in the West have actually enjoyed the fruits of that industrialization, which has caused pollution. And this pollution is responsible for global warming and climate change. And developing countries who are not responsible for the crisis are facing these disasters. So it's an ecological debt that US and other countries have to pay. And to understand the emissions that have been put, US is responsible for one quarter of emissions historically. And same with European Union. So they have to put money on the table. This is the least that they can do to help people who are suffering from impact for no cause of theirs.
So let's go to this issue of climate migrants. ActionAid spoke to climate migrants, your organization, in Bangladesh. Let's go to some of those voices.
I couldn't eat a single grain of rice because I was in such a traumatic state. My most painful memory was when I gave my house to the person I borrowed money from. If I can work hard enough to save money for a house, even if it takes 10 years, then I will do it. Who would ever willingly want to leave their hometown to move to Dhaka?
When the flooding happens, we leave our homes and go to the cyclone center. But it's not possible to take it all.
Water levels are rising day by day. They, Piara's family, went to Dhaka because they weren't even earning enough to feed themselves. I don't want to be compelled to go to Dhaka. We would like support so that ultimately we can support ourselves independently in our hometown.
My land and housing have been destroyed. Every year there's a flooding. How many disasters can one tolerate year after year?
There you have some climate migrants from Bangladesh speaking with ActionAid, our guest Harjit Singh, global lead on climate change and ActionAid. You know, the U.S. Pentagon, even if President Trump denies climate change, calling it a Chinese hoax, the Pentagon full well understands the pressure of climate change and has talked about it being the driver of war in the 21st century. Explain how that can be from Bangladesh to other countries around the world, even the migrant caravans in Latin America making their way north, the discussions of drought and what people are fleeing, even drought as a pressure in Syria.
Absolutely. So what we saw as Syrian crisis was a preview of what's going to happen in the next few decades. When people have no option, they have no food, their houses get washed away, and they have nowhere to go, what else they do? They leave their homes, they first go to bigger cities, then they go to capitals, and when they have no opportunity there, they also cross borders. So even if that is a fraction of number, that number is going to rise. And we have no protection mechanism for them. So it's very clear that the scale of migration that we are going to see caused by climate change is going to increase several folds. And this is only when we are living in a 1 degree warmer world. It's very important to recognize that. The impacts at 1.5 degree, 2 degree are going to be several folds. And at this moment, the current level of emissions, we are moving towards a 3 degree warmer world. It's going to be devastating for them, and when they have no option, they will put their lives in danger and cross borders.
Explain what this UN science report means, even with the U.S. joining with Saudi Arabia, Russia, and Kuwait, and saying they won't welcome the report, they'll simply note it. This Nobel Peace Prize-winning scientific body of the United Nations saying that we've got 12 years when it comes to climate change before catastrophe occurs. What does that mean?
It means that we now have to bring the discussion of limited carbon budget right at the center. At UNFCCC climate talks, they have long avoided what is that cake looks like, cake of carbon budget, how much we can more emit so that we don't go beyond 1.5 degree temperature threshold, and how to cut the cake, which is technically known as equity. Now, they call this equity discussions very toxic because that's where responsibilities are fixed. We know that this cake of responsibility is largely belongs to developed countries. They now have to cut the cake, which means they have to put their plans on the table, how much emission reduction I'm going to do in my own respective country, and how much money I'm going to provide to developing countries so that they can also reduce emissions.
I mean, this term climate equity is so important.
Absolutely. And we have avoided even at climate talks, but look at what climate science says. It has clearly put 12 years deadline in front of us, and we have to bring the emissions down by half by 2050.
And that's and the yet kind. They've increased.
Exactly. And the emissions are going up. And this year, it's all projected that the emissions are going to go up. It's going to be the highest level of emissions ever we have seen. So we are not going in the right direction. Here at Katowice, that's why it's so important to make sure that the rule book is robust. It talks about ambition, but it also enables ambition by providing finance to developing countries.
So talk about the U.S. spokesperson who said at the only side panel the U.S. is hosting, where they push fossil fuels and coal, and nuclear power. He said that they are trying to ensure a level playing field. Last year, the same thing said as they talked about
increasing the visibility of fossil fuels and coal. This year, the State Department saying ensuring a level playing field that benefits and protects U.S. interests. Would you argue it's actually in U.S. interest to deal with climate change?
A level playing field for whom? For fossil fuel companies that are responsible for causing the crisis? And U.S. and other developed countries like Saudi Arabia are protecting the interest of these fossil fuel companies. They have much more power than developing countries and people who are facing climate impact. And it's not even in U.S. favor. We have seen fires in California. We have seen Hurricane Harvey. So even U.S. citizens' life is at stake. So we need to put pressure on the government. So it's not just about developing countries. As we say, climate change knows no borders. Everybody is going to get affected. But what is important to recognize that it's developing countries. One, they are not responsible for the problem. Second, they don't have resources to deal with it. And third, there's also an opportunity for that they adopt a much greener development pathway.
So let's talk about another phrase that's UN lingo, but is so much more than that when it comes to the devastation on the ground, and that's the term loss and damage. I wanted to turn to the environment minister of the Maldives, speaking Tuesday about financing for the developing countries most vulnerable to the adverse impacts of climate change.
We continue to be very concerned by what appears to be deliberate attempts to isolate loss and damage in the negotiations. Loss and damage is an undeniable part of our reality today and must be reflected by incorporating it into the transparency framework, global stocktake and finance. We need to identify how finance flows, both public and private, reflects the 1.5 degree goal and are reaching those who need support the most, especially small island developing states and the least developed countries.
That's the environment minister of the Maldives speaking Tuesday. Top representatives of countries from all over the world are in one plenary, each one addressing the world about climate change. Our guest is Harjeet Singh, because there are also thousands of activists from around the world. He is from India, New Delhi, to be exact, global lead on climate change at ActionAid. If you could elaborate on what the environment minister said from this Pacific island nation of Maldives.
So let me put things into context. When we talk about climate action, there are three pillars of climate action. One is mitigation, which is about emission reduction and protecting forest. Second is about adaptation, which means being much more prepared to deal with climate impact so that we are not impacted, which means retrofitting your houses, building dikes, making sure that your agriculture is climate resilient. The third aspect is what happens when you're already getting affected. That's the loss and damage. That has become a third pillar of climate action. And we fought very hard in Paris to make sure that it is separated from adaptation and has its own article. So Article 8 of the Paris Agreement is about loss and damage. Now, this is where it has become a lot more contentious at Katowice. We would like to have global stocktake, which is a ratchet-up mechanism every 5 years, to have focus on all three aspects in addition to financing. Developed countries, particularly U.S., Australia, Canada, Japan are resisting to have this language included in the global stocktake. Now, it is fundamental for Pacific nations and all developing countries, because if you don't have that element, then in every 5 years, you will not be talking of people. We'll only be talking of solar panels. We'll be talking of wind farms. We'll be talking of, are we doing something to prepare for climate impacts, but not about people who are already getting impacted. We are living in a situation where many people are going to be relocated because the place are either going to be swallowed by sea or going to be unairable. What would happen to such people? We need to have a mechanism in place so that we can deal with loss and damage.
Do you see a connection between the pressures of climate change and the massive exodus of climate refugees and right-wing governments, authoritarian governments, erecting walls, for example, in Hungary, or the president of the United States on the southern border is threatening to shut down the U.S. government if he doesn't get financing for his wall. Do you see a connection between authoritarian governments' rise and the pressures of refugees trying to leave plagued areas?
Yes, there is connection, but what we need to understand that things are going to get much worse if we don't act now. Nobody would like to leave her or his home because they're not getting greener pastures. They are going to live in they're putting their life in danger while in transit, and they're living in very insecure environment, with a lot of uncertainty. So it's not that everybody is willing to come to Europe or the United States. People would like to remain there, while we also recognize that mobility is a fundamental right recognized by the UN. So we have to put systems in place that we are not forcing people and driving people away from their homes. That's why discussions here are far more important, to make sure that there's money on the table and we are ready to help people who are being forced to migrate.
You say this is the most important summit since The Paris Accord was signed?
So in Paris, we had an agreement, and now it's about operationalizing the agreement by having a robust rule book in place. If that doesn't happen, where are the rules to make sure that Paris Agreement is implemented in toto?
What does stringent reporting mean, Harjeet?
See, the kind of plans countries have put on the table are of a different nature. Some are talking about reducing carbon intensity. Some are talking about absolute reductions in different sectors like transport, energy. Some are talking about economy-wide emission reduction. So there are going to be different metrics. So we need to have a system in place so that we are able to understand where we are heading in terms of emissions and emission reduction patterns. For that, you need to have a reporting system. But let's also understand that not all countries have same level of technical institutions to capture that information and do reporting periodically, which means we have to have some flexibility and support built in making sure that the report is coming and it's true and we are able to get a good sense of what's going on. Now, that comes under the whole transparency system, and the United States is pushing very hard on transparency when it comes to reporting, but there is another side to it. It's about transparency of finance and support. The moment you talk about transparency of finance, things get stuck. There is no movement on how money is going to be provided.